The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to a Film Weekly London Film Festival special with me, Jason Solomons. This week we're out and about in London at the Soho Hotel, no less, as the capital readies itself for the BFI London Film Festival. Zan Brooks and I will be tipping you the wink on what you shouldn't miss if you are festival bound. And Found in Translation, Let Me In, which screens at the LFF this week. It's a remake of last year's Swedish horror classic, Let the Right One In. Normally a bad move, but this time, I hope you're in for a pleasant, unpleasant surprise. I meet the director, Matt Reeves, and its young star, Cody Smit-McPhee, to talk blood and friendship. Also this week, I meet Sophie Fiennes to discuss the immersive cinematic universe of her new documentary about German artist Anselm Kiefer, Over Your Cities, Grass Will Grow. We also talk to Mark Romanek, director of Never Let Me Go, the opening night gala of this year's London Film Festival. So, yes, it's out, but not down. It's Film Weekly. So, what happens when you turn this...
You must be able to hear me.
What happens if I don't do it? What happens if I go in then? Is there something here?
Into this...
A few days ago,
victim completely drained of blood.
Please don't see that boy again.
Where's your dad? He pissed on my dad.
Well, something very interesting indeed. Let the Right One In, by Swedish director Thomas Alfredson, a tale of a young boy's friendship with a vampire, won both critical acclaim and the eye of some Hollywood executives. So the remake, Let Me In, screens at the London Film Festival and gets an early November release here in the UK. The original's Oscar becomes Owen, played by Cody Smit-McPhee from The Road, and Ellie is now Abby, played by Chloe Moretz. So I was delighted to meet up with the team behind Let Me In, Cody Smit-McPhee and his director, Matt Reeves, to find out more.
Are you a vampire? I need blood. To live. But how old are you? Really? 12. Been 12 for a very long time.
Matt Reeves, Cody Smit-McPhee, beautiful to see you. Thank you very much for joining us on Film Weekly. Congratulations on Let Me In. I'm going to invite you into the show just in case, because I think there's danger if we don't. You might burst into flames.
You don't want us to bleed through our pores.
No, yeah. Please don't. There's messy on the sofa. We'll have to pay for it. Yeah. It's not going to work. Cody, I'm going to start with you, because Matt's the director. He's been in this a long time. Not important. It's a terrific performance from you in the film. I loved your look, and I loved the kind of frightened aspect of you. Did you work on that with Matt, or did you know how you wanted to play Owen?
Well, when I read the script, I already get a feel for the character, but when I start getting into it more, it's when I work with my dad, and we make a whole life for the character, and there's really a lot more that goes into it. I read the script like 8 times, and mm-hmm. write about it, and then write why I'm saying that, and I gotta know everything, what's going on, so I'm not just saying lines.
Wow. Yeah, that's good. That comes across. Did you look at the original film? Obviously, the part of Oscar, wasn't it? The original kid that played it. Did you look at that and kind of think, well, I need to do a bit different, or maybe Owen's a different character to that guy?
I didn't see it, and I don't think a lot of people did, and Matt didn't want anyone to see it.
Right.
So, we all did really our own take on it, and okay. I think Matt was the only one that had it in his head.
Last time you were at the London Film Festival was with The Road, this time last year, and it was, again, a very different character, although there are vampires in that one as well. Cannibals, I suppose.
Yeah, cannibal kind of things that eat each other, but... Vampires, cannibals. Yeah.
What is it with you? You're very tasty or something.
Yeah, something like that. Smell good.
Matt, if I will turn to you, you told the cast not to look at the original film. I presume that was mainly Chloe and Cody. Did you tell Richard Jenkins well?
No, actually, none of the cast had seen it. Elias hadn't seen it, and Richard Jenkins, none of the cast had mm-hmm. seen it.
You had seen it.
I had seen the movie, and I was shown the movie by... a distributor that I was bringing a project to right as Cloverfield came out. So the movie didn't come out in the United States for about another year almost. And my first response was, you shouldn't remake this movie because it's wonderful. But I really related to the coming-of-age story, and I ended up reading the novel. They were pursuing the rights during that time anyway, and I kind of became obsessed with it.
Because the novel is quite different to the movie that Thomas Alfredson made, and he's been on the show, and he was quite sort of bald about the fact that he took a risk, because it was quite a best-selling novel. He took quite a risk making his movie slightly different to that novel.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because he obviously worked on the film with Lindquist. I mean, Lindquist wrote the script, and they obviously adapted what they wanted to take. I think the brilliant job in terms of that particular adaptation, in addition to the amazing way that it was directed, I thought it was beautiful, was that in terms of what they focused on, the novel is, I don't know if you've read the novel, but it's huge. And if you were going to do the full version of the novel, it would be like doing a 10-hour miniseries. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what that adaptation sort of did was focus it in on what is the main thrust of the story, which is the coming-of-age story. Mm-hmm. And what I tried to do was to take the story and even more so put it into Owen's point of view, the boy's point of view, and to take some of the plot and put it into the story as it related to that point of view. So some of the characters that in the book and even in the Swedish film, you get into more detail about who they are. Here, you sort of see them through Owen's eyes. I made him into a bit of a voyeur. He was looking out into the world of adults, and it was very much about coming of age.
There's a bit of Rear Window going on there, kind of definitely influenced that when you're kind of like telescoping around the yard.
Or Keith Lowski's short film about love, or the Decalogue,
I'm sure you've seen all of those, Cody.
Yes, I have.
I'm going to be a bit controversial here. I know I'm a big fan of world cinema, and on the show we support world cinema. And in fact, Thomas Alfredson won Best Foreign Film at my Critics Circle Award last year. I preferred your film, Let Me In. Can I say that?
You can say that. That's very flattering. That's very kind. Well,
I know they're both really good. It's not like one's bad and one's.
I mean, I think his film is just amazing, and that's very flattering.
I haven't spoken to him about seeing yours yet, but I think they're significantly different, and the differences between them are what's fascinating. I love the fact that you managed to find a place that has the sort of very similar climbing frame thing in the middle. But it did. We're seeing it in your film. Made me realize that, even though I enjoyed it in the Swedish setting, and I even spoke to Thomas about, odd to see Sweden look like that. Uh-huh. It actually really suited that kind of motel, kind of classic American setting where there would be a swimming pool normally.
Well, that's what I was looking for, actually. When the one of the ways that we ended up going to New Mexico is that I was trying to find the quintessential sort of apartment building that I grew up in, actually.
Oh.
And when we found that particular spot, I was like, oh, this is it. Because, you know, you get a lot of sort of nondescript buildings, and I love the ones from the Swedish film. They remind me of Kieslowski, like that kind of like worker housing. But I knew that wasn't the American version, and I thought, you know, this story could take place in an American context, and I wanted it to be one of those sort of mid-century, you know, motel-looking apartment complexes. And when we found it in New Mexico, that confirmed it for me. We had to shoot there.
Right, so I wonder which came first. You, like, find somewhere that looked like the right location and then choose it. It had to be, obviously, somewhere where it snowed.
Yes, it had to be somewhere where it snowed. And originally I had considered Colorado because I kind of saw a strange comparison. You know, in the book, Oscar is very much obsessed with serial killers, and he's bullied mercilessly, and you get the feeling that things are not going in a good direction. And it kind of reminded me of Columbine. It reminded me of, and I thought a lot about when we were shooting the movie Elephant, you know, the
Gus
Yeah, and I was thinking a lot about that. And so I thought, well, what about Colorado? But it turned out that they didn't have tax incentives. But
but I do want to just finish up, because you're here at the London Film Festival just before your film comes out. Great news for the film, I suppose, to be at the London Film Festival. Last year I mentioned you were in the road, but you weren't here, Cody.
Yeah.
Is it nice to finally get here and support the film that you're
in? Yeah, it's cool. I've never been to London before, and obviously being here for my film, it's awesome. And I love the place.
Yeah? Are you going to get out and about?
Yeah, I think tomorrow I have a free day, so I'll be able to do some stuff and travel a bit. But the traffic here, it's weird. Like, the streets are so small and stuff, and I never really know where I'm going, what direction.
Where do you live? Where are you from?
Melbourne, Australia. So it's a bit more open, kind of like LA. But it's really historical here. I think the buildings are all really old and stuff. It's cool.
There'd be vampires in some of those buildings. Watch out.
Better watch out.
Cody, lovely to see you. Congratulations on your performance. Really Thanks. Tender and frightening and little scary little performance. But you're a very nice boy, really.
Thank you.
And Matt Reeves, congratulations on the film. A really, really tough job to kind of take. I don't know why they don't remake bad films. Let's remake a good film, because it's harder. But you've actually done, I think, a really impossible task and done it brilliantly.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
From vampires to umpires, Zan, you join me. We can be the judge of films this week and at the LFF. Do you see what I've done there?
The hanging jury, are we?
We are indeed. Anything else that's coming up at the LFF that is interesting for you? Some of our listeners may be heading to London. Or we do this often from Venice and Cannes, safely in the knowledge that none of our listeners are going to come up and bite us on the bum and say, I've just seen that, because they're stuck at home or wherever they are. But they might come to London.
Well, indeed. In terms of stuff that I've seen already, I was very impressed with Anton Corbijn's The American, with George Clooney.
Oh, and Violanta Placido.
Oh, Violanta.
Who has captured my heart somewhat.
And hers yours, I think.
I believe so. You can see that interview later on the guardian.co.uk website. She's very gorgeous in it. Did you like George in it?
I thought George was brilliant in it.
Too.
But I've always kind of liked George. I mean, occasionally you get sort of stuck with the comedy shtick a little bit, which becomes a bit
moustache.
But here he's playing properly dark, and it's a good role for him. It's a good, meaty performance.
Yeah, interesting choice. Anton Corbijn obviously was such a success with Control. Here he is doing a very different film.
Yeah, and I think that is, it's part of the reason maybe why this film has struggled a little bit in America, in that, you know, it's almost a case of false advertising. It's a thriller with George Clooney as a hitman, and so people go in expecting something. But you've got this very abstracted, cerebral, cold film, almost like Melville's The Samurai.
Yeah, he's an existential hitman.
Yeah, and I think that has flummoxed some people, but that is what makes it a good film.
It's also got some damn good sex scenes in there, and you just don't see enough of that. So.
You don't.
Well, I mean, not my house.
Not the festivals that we go to.
That's true. Zen, I mean, that's The American, which I think opens soon. I saw Blue Valentine.
Oh, yeah, what's
Did you
that?
See that in Cannes? It's Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams in a kind of Cassavetes-like kind of marital battleground. Very good, actually.
Very good.
Did a little US indie film. That's coming out soon. Watch out for that. I saw Meek's Cut Off, finally.
Yes, I saw that, and I thought that was very good.
Oh,
again, Michelle Williams in it again.
Yeah,
didn't
well, that's
like
why
it.
I sort of go to those. I'm on my notes, it puts Meek's Nod Off.
Again, possibly false advertising. It's a Western, but it's not Peckinpah, is it, really?
No, it's not in any pecking order, I mate. I'll tell you as well. I'm looking forward to seeing Black Swan here at the LFF.
Yeah, me too. Same here.
I'm
looking
Venice.
Forward to seeing Uncle Boon Me, which I managed to miss at Cannes.
Oh, famously, yes.
Yeah.
The Cannes Palme
d'Or. Notoriously.
Yes, I suppose so. Well, I would see that again, but I don't think I've got time, frankly.
Yeah, it's not enough time.
I'm really
in your
glad
life.
That I've seen it, and
yeah,
it's in my head
but
still.
Never,
I
ever
don't
again.
Really need to see it again, to be honest. Richard Ayoade, he's much hyped now, a comedian, obviously, he's in the IT Crowd and the Mighty Boosh. He's made his directorial debut. It got very good reviews from Toronto, where the Weinstein Company's picked up this little film, I believe, and it's here. It shows here at the LFF. It's called Submarine. Mm-hmm. It stars Sally Hawkins and Paddy Considine. It's very whimsical and sweet and funny, I have to say. I was very impressed with it.
Good.
I think he's but it's almost like the film is like him himself. It's kind of serious but funny.
Yeah.
And kind of slightly kind of kooky.
Right.
Which
so it's
is
the work of a proper auteur.
In a way, yes. A big future for him at film festivals and nowhere else probably. Zander, finally the big number, I think, is unveiling here in the UK, and I'm getting mixed reports about this. Is The King's Speech, starring Colin Firth and Geoffrey Rush as the stuttering king?
Yeah, this is this came out of Toronto as the big Oscar favourite, and that can be a poison chalice, really. I remember this time last year, the big film coming out of Toronto as the big Oscar favourite was Bright Star by Jane Campion. Mm-hmm. Everyone said that's the film to beat at the Oscars, and I think it got like two nominations and no wins. So there's a sort of danger in this in terms of sort of peaking too early. I haven't seen it. The trailer makes it look like it's the sort of British film that plays very well to an American audience.
Yeah, that's my feeling on it too.
In that Colin Firth is the sort of stumbling, stuttering king who grows in stature and leads the nation. But, you know, and it ties into sort of the Americans fond notion of us Brits as sort of these slightly bumbling, eccentric, posh people.
I'm looking forward to it at the London Film Festival. What I hope this happens is that British filmmaking goes, do you know what? It's not 1973 or 1945. It is now, it is here, and we have something to say. I really want that to happen.
So what are the films that are going to say that?
Well, I don't know. I'm not. Submarine, it's kind of set in the sort of 80s because it's this kind of memory for school film. I've seen a documentary about the West Indian cricket team. That was sort of 1974 to 1989. I don't know. I'm looking for a kind of state of the nation, kind of just here and now. Even Peter Mullen's new film, Ned's, which I thought was very good, but again, it was set in the 70s. I'm like, come on.
Yeah. What did you make of Mike Lee's Another Year, which is also playing here?
Well, that's sort of set now.
It's set now. I mean, it's about older people, so maybe it's not... About
no,
the,
I'm not. I don't have to be trendy. I just want to kind of
come on. You want it to be trendy.
If trendy it could be, then good. Now, I like Mike Lee's film Another Year. It plays on Monday as a gala here.
Yeah, I loved it.
I think it's a really beautiful piece, kind of Ozu like. I think we sort of mentioned it at Cannes, and I think I'm really interested in seeing how that does. I'm a big Mike Lee fan, and so I found this work very different and interesting in his canon. I'm not sure it's a sort of Mike Lee film that, if you've never seen a Mike Lee film, you'd go and sort of say, wow, this is amazing.
Possibly not. I thought it was maybe a more subtle, refined film than some of his others. So in that way, I think it will win over people who maybe have always had a problem with his slight, occasional use of caricatures and these sort of grand gestures.
It's one of those middle-class films he's made.
It is, very much. Unashamedly middle-class.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Jim Broadbent is just masterfully. Mm. I know people are sort of really talking about Leslie Manville in it, but I think Jim Broadbent is...
Yeah, it's one of the great Jim Broadbent performances.
Yeah, exactly.
This.
I think it's a genre in itself.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
We talked about films there are at the LFF. We shall come back to those as the LFF progresses. But we must talk about the big film that is out in the UK cinemas this week. We mentioned Andrew Garfield because he's in the opening night gala, Never Let Me Go. He also stars, as an American this time, in David Fincher's The Social Network.
Good, that looks really good.
It's clean and simple.
But you're right.
Relationship status. Interested in. This is what drives life at college. Are you having sex or aren't you? It's why people take certain classes and sit where they sit and do what they do when at some center, you know? That's what the Facebook is going to be about. People are going to log on because after all the cake and watermelon, there's a chance they're actually going
to get laid.
Meet a girl. Yes.
That is really good.
And that was it.
What do you mean?
It's ready.
It's ready?
Yeah.
Right now?
That was it.
So when's it going live?
Right now. Get your laptop out.
Andrew Garfield and Jesse Eisenberg there as the people who founded Facebook. I'm not a great technology fan, and although, of course, Film Weekly does appear on Facebook, so we must kind of bow to the great God. We're on Twitter as well. Film Weekly fans, that's us. Do check us out. But, Zan, the founding of Facebook, does it make for cinematic gold?
Well, in theory, no, not at all. But actually, it does. And I thought this was great. This is directed by David Fincher from a script by Aaron Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin, who gives The West Wing, of
The
course.
West Wing, of course, yeah. And again, I guess Fincher is fascinated by these unreliable characters and unreliable stories. I mean, a couple of years ago he did obviously Zodiac, which famously ends where you don't actually know whether they've got the right guy or not, or who it is. We still don't know. And this is set up in a similar way. It's Mark Zuckerberg, played by Eisenberg, who founds Face Mash while he's at Harvard, which is just kind of rating hot women on campus. Mm. And from this spins into Facebook.
Yeah, I kind of wish Facebook was still that. It is that, in a way.
I guess it kind of is, really.
And the I whole, don't get one
real. The whole rise of social networking. Mm. And yet the great irony of this film is that this is the master social networker who has no social skills at all. He's a borderline sociopath.
Is the film therefore a comment on the modern world?
Yes, I think
it
is.
You can have millions of friends and yet still not be able to talk to anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he pioneered the use of friend as a verb, but has no idea how to treat a friend. Mm. And he sells his friends down the river, and the most notably Eduardo, played by Andrew Garfield. But everybody else. So he is a sort of an anti-hero that we haven't really seen on screen before.
Is he not just another in the kind of long line of boring line, I would say, of geeks as heroes these days?
I don't think he's a hero, though. I think he's a pretty screwed up individual.
He's a protagonist.
He is the protagonist. He's very much the anti-hero. And even anti-hero invests him with a kind of glamour that I'm not sure he has.
He keeps going on in the film about Facebook's being cool. Oh, we're cool right now. There's nothing so cool as seeing someone say, I'm cool. Is that intentional? What
I think that's intentional. I mean, it sounds like you came out of this film thinking that we were supposed to find this exciting journey and identify with him. I didn't.
In a way, well, I think you are supposed to, because cinema requires that of the hero sometimes, or it's a much more complex kind of journey.
I think it's a very dark, caustic film, this.
It is, yet it's done in a kind of slick kind of jibber-jabber kind of way. Yeah. Aaron Sorkin, fast talking, and then you come out. But I just kept going, I don't like you.
No, I didn't like him at all.
2.5 hours of going, I don't like you.
But some of the great films, you think, I don't like you.
I don't know. I always kind of come round to them, I have to say. I don't have a problem with an anti-hero. I do have a problem with a kind of a guy who, with a film whose arc is, well, the key line from the film is, 1 million, that's not cool. I'll tell you what's cool, 1 billion.
But that's true, though, Jason. Come on, that's what we all think.
I don't need 1 billion. 2 million would do me, I thought to myself as I watched this. I kind of thought it was slightly innovative. And there was one bit where I used to think, well, cinema heroes used to be about, you know, heroes taking on heroes. This one, it's like Andrew Garfield in the key scene says to Jesse Eisenberg, you better lawyer up. I'm like, has it really come to just kind of, what happened to fisticuffs? What happened to good old rough and tumble? Lawyer up? I mean, what's that?
But you know what we've got here? We've got kind of what you were hoping for from Britain from this year's London Film Festival. You've got a film that is about the world that we live in now. Mm. And however ugly and confused and ambiguous that is. And here it is.
Yeah, it's just a load of
people. You get what you want, and then you find you don't want it.
Well, it's just people sitting in offices, kind of talking
over. That's the world.
Do you think?
That's what we do.
This is what we're doing now, right now. At least we're arguing. But those that have lawyers arguing for them.
Yes, they do. And again, that, I'm sure, is entirely intentional. I thought it was kind of cinematic. I think Fincher is a great director.
Well, I like Benjamin Button, and no one else did.
I like Benjamin Button.
Oh, cool.
But I think he sets himself these sort of challenges. He sets the bar high. How do I make a film about something this uncinematic? And where there's no actual answers, there's no foundation.
No, I did like this. I thought it was very entertaining as I watched it. I found I could sort of throw a lot of stuff at it. And it may be a state of the nation, state of the world kind of thing that's going on. I kind of wanted a bit more out of the motion of it as well.
Yeah.
I love Fincher for the fluidity of his camera as well. And I felt that was slightly missing it because it's just people sitting down in offices.
It doesn't have the big payoff. It trails off, and it's got the great hanging ending where he's just refreshing the page, waiting for a response.
Well, aren't we all in some way, Zan? Maybe it's an existentially brilliant film. Just didn't get me the social network, but I'm glad it got you. Zan, your hits on Facebook will go up and up, and mine will just kind of peter out.
Yeah, I've got so many friends, Jason.
Zan Brooks, lovely to see you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
We'll immerse
ourselves
in the
We'll be back here next week.
And you can tell me what you've seen, and I'll tell you what I've seen. If we've seen the same things, then we can fight about them.
Yeah.
In a bit of rough
and tumble. If not, we can just tell each other.
If not, lawyer up, mate.
Next week we'll come with the lawyers.
Thanks to Zan there. For more of Zan and the best from the London Film Festival, go to guardian.co.uk/film. One of the many masterclasses at this year's LFF is with Olivier Assayas, whose film Carlos will screen in the first week. But we on Film Weekly have a pair of tickets to give away to that masterclass. It's on October the 24th. All you've got to do to win them is tell us the hygienic title to his 2004 film starring Maggie Cheung. Clue is in the question. Email your answers to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk.
Oui, maintenant c'était bon. Alors on fait comme ça.
Et on le coupe.
Et le reste on coupe, mais trois. D'accord?
The sounds there of German artist Anselm Kiefer as the work literally emerges from the dust and chaos of his studio. It's a scene from the brilliant new observational documentary Over Your City's Grass Will Grow by British filmmaker Sophie Fiennes. And Sophie, I'm delighted to say, joins me now in the slightly more controlled surroundings of the Soho Hotel here in London. Sophie, we're at the start of the London Film Festival. Your film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, which I suppose was kind of relevant given that Anselm Kiefer's city that you document is in the hills in France, in Barjac. Can you just tell me about that place? Because for people who haven't seen the film or heard of Anselm's kind of creation there, can you tell us what it's like?
Well, of course, my first response is to say you just have to go see the film. But in brief, Kiefer is a German artist, canonical in terms of German painting of the 20th century. He left Germany in 1993 and he took on this derelict silk factory in the south of France, which he first started working in as an artist with studios, painting studios, sculpting studios, and then some strange spirit possessed him to start creating a very weird world within this landscape. He started digging tunnels, made a labyrinth of tunnels, underground rooms, an amphitheater made out of concrete cast from the sides of transport haulage containers, with a kind of strange back rooms and projection theaters of lead, rolls of lead film, and then a landscape of towers made out of concrete.
So when you visit it, is it like seeing a town set out before you? I mean, I haven't visited the place, but I've obviously seen your film. The gradual picture, because you start quite in close, and it's almost
a mystery. I start in the very smallest space, which is this underground lead room, and then it ends with the very widest, which is this vast landscape of the towers.
So it's almost like a Pompeii, it seems to me.
Yes, it does. It has that feeling of a Pompeii. I mean, part of the pleasure of making a film of this work is that it lends itself to cinema, because it has a sort of drama to it. And at the same time, I feel like what he's made there is going to change, and it is a sort of work in progress. So there's another side to the film which we show him as an artist making work and artistic processes.
The title of your film is Over Your City's Grass Will Grow. I learned from Anselm in the film that this comes from Genesis, from the Bible.
From Isaiah.
From Isaiah.
I haven't been reading the Bible recently.
No, I stop at Ezekiel. I never get past Isaiah.
Ezekiel's good,
It's a prophecy that it's about the cycles of decay and life and you know what will happen, I suppose, to human folly in some way, or human creation, whether it's folly or not. But that's very much sort of ongoing in your film. You see the creations of him inside the industrial metals, and outside you see the trees and the grass. And I'm saying this because you start small, and that was almost one of the first things you see is outside of the window. There's an artwork and then there's nature. Was that what struck you, and that's what drew you into this world?
Well, certainly. I mean, in the editing of the material, as I sort of analysed it and studied how I could arrange it, it would seem that to create this sense of being embedded underground, and then to feel the sense of the light and emerging out of the underground, and feeling the nature, and then this, you know, sweeping over some of the pavilions and having this kind of relief of there being natural light before you go down back into the labyrinth.
One of the great things about your film is that it's got time in it. You soak up time. You actually kind of feel time in a way. There are dolly shots and zooms and pan outs that you actually
tracks,
feel.
Not zooms, tracks.
I was going to ask what's the technical aspect? Did you lay tracks along the?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I first was taken and shown Barjac, shown what he created there, I said to him, sort of tongue in cheek, but not so tongue in cheek, I said, we have to think like Leni Riefenstahl here, in terms of her choreographic sense of camera. And, you know, she famously invented ways to be able to move through space or to show space. I said, you know, we need dollies on tracks, we need long tracks and high cranes that can go really high as the towers. And so there was always this feeling that, you know, with the mechanics of cinema, you could possibly register something onto film that was is a physical space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the closest I've ever seen to it is Sokurov's Russian Ark, but that was a Steadicam shot, one Steadicam shot that went around the Hermitage Museum.
Yeah, I mean, I was thrilled when a couple of people thought that the first 10 minutes of the film is one shot. Of course, it isn't. But I worked with some brilliant grips who we managed to establish the kind of the pacing of the tracking shots, so that when they're all cut together, it feels like it's a continuous camera move, but of course it's a series of shots.
Yeah, the other interesting thing, and one thing that I noticed immediately, which is probably the one thing that is a very cinematic kind of invention, is putting soundtrack on it. Because when you go to Barjac, I assume that you are not accompanied by anything other than ambient sound of birds chirping or someone knocking some hammers around and building some other stuff further in the valley. Yeah. You chose some eerie score. You chose Ligeti, which obviously one always thinks of Kubrick when you think of Ligeti, and when you're doing some graceful, elegant camera work, that was sort of came to my head. Where did you get that sound? Because I would have thought if I go to Barjac, it's that wouldn't be the first sound that's in my head. So I'm intrigued where you got that kind of score from.
Yes, well, I discussed with Anselm, you know, okay, we're going to make this registration kind of very cinematic rendering of it, and you know, you end up with 38 minutes of screen time of his world, and so you know, it's a film, it's a kind of practical reality of how are you going to create the tension for the audience to be engaged with the work, you know, and anything you put on audio-wise is going to say something. So you know, that was I had to think very hard, and I had to explore, and I explored many different kind of options. And then I was actually, because I don't really know much about classical modern music, but I was reading this brilliant book, trying to educate myself, called The Rest is Noise, which is this book by Alex Ross about, it's the history of the 20th century through classical music. Oh. So it starts with Strauss and, of course, Stravinsky in The Rite of Spring, and then and Mahler, and goes through Schoenberg, and then, you know, you get to Ligeti. And when I was reading about the Ligeti from the point of view of how it's made, in terms of the fact that it has kind of layers of sound, yeah. It's an orchestral, he's using an orchestra, but at the same time he's not using harmony to resolve in an anthemic way. There's an ambiguity or there's an undecidability in the music. Mm-hmm. He uses tension and texture, but he doesn't have this kind of bombastic sense of closure, yeah. But he's using the kind of bombast of an orchestra orchestration. So this kind of grand sweep of the orchestra also ties in for me with the sort of the grand sweep of history that Kiefer refers to, but also has this texture. And more fascinatingly, in Ligeti's understand his sense of what he was trying to make with this music, and he called it music statique, which again relates to the monumentality of the Kiefer project, which is all very, very big. That this idea that he wanted to use music to make to freeze time. So when you say that there's this sense of time in the film, I think that's partly because of Ligeti's deliberate choice as a composer to try to use music to create a sense of time that was kind of static and monumental.
Glad I asked you about Ligeti. It wasn't something you just threw on.
And then, of course, I cheekily thought, oh, well, you know, it wasn't something I certainly wasn't.
I just had to be listening to it one day in the studio. I thought, this will work. Because your film is so kind of textual and feeling and kind of, you know, you want to kind of reach out and grab stuff in it. Yeah. It's kind of one of those art films that perhaps, I'm not a big fan of 3D, but actually 3D for yours might have been.
No, I'm actually fascinated by this 3D thing because, you see, one of the big preoccupations for me is space in cinema. And we've talked about time, but space is a huge component. Mm. And, you know, in the classic cinematic grammar that was sort of basically devised in America, it was all about creating space. And if you create space, you create an intimacy. So even though these spaces are very vast, you know, I'm always trying to put my camera in a place where when I cut it, you'll feel that you're in the space physically. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, we've had this excitement in cinema recently in the last 10 years with kinetic cutting and very fast, this kind of Paul Greengrass speed and sort of, you know, kind of frenzied compression. But what you lose with that is space. And so it's interesting to me that there's been this sudden kind of like attention to 3D as a way to try to reclaim space in cinema through 3D. But it doesn't, it's not actually as efficient as the kind of careful plotting of space, what they call cinematic staging, which, you know, as, you know, fascinates me. Yeah.
Well, I find it fascinating. The new slow, I think we're going to kind of new movement right here.
New slow.
Yeah, it's like that slow cooking thing that they do in Italy.
Slow cooking.
Slow shooting. That's what. But it was a beautiful way to digest Anselm. But I can't wait to get out to Barjac. I love the fact that he uses a bicycle to get around his work.
Now, this is really interesting that you're saying that about the bicycle, because actually a couple of people said to me that they wanted to start a group of people to cycle to Barjac. So I thought that was I'm going to tell Anselm that there's a whole kind of, there's a plot to people to cycle there. And, you know, there's Alain, who you see in the film, is actually the gatekeeper. So, you know, you now know who you've got to kind of, flirt with or persuade to open the gates for you, because Anselm's not there, but Alain is there.
All right, Alain's there. I should cross his palm with silver, whether flirting might not work. Lovely to see you. In Cannes, you were pregnant. You were on the recovery. You were pregnant. It was 6 months ago, so you were about 8 months pregnant, so yes. I assume that everything's gone well and you had issues.
A lovely, very beautiful son called Horace.
Oh, how old is he now?
He'll be 10 weeks on Saturday.
Brilliant. Well, congratulations on that. I mean, birthing a son and a film at the same time must have been kind of...
It's fun. Exactly. I think Anselm was quite jealous of me, actually.
Right, well, yeah, you see, he needs to get... he wants to get...
He wants to have a baby.
Maybe that's what he'll do next. But for now, Over Your City's Grass Will Grow stands as a testament to both his work and to yours. Sophie Fiennes, thanks so much for coming
on
Film Weekly.
Thanks a lot.
My thanks to Sophie Fiennes for her brilliant film Over Your City's Grass Will Grow, released here in the UK this Friday, the 15th of October. For more information and some truly beautiful clips of it, go to overyourcities.com. That's us done for this week. For more information and tickets for the LFF, go to bfi.org.uk/LFF. The music sprinkled throughout this week's podcast is from the soundtrack to Sophie Fiennes' documentary. She's been talking about it at full length in the interview. It's Georgi Legaty there. Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my LFF film roundup, the best film news and reviews and gossip. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, down at the London Film Festival, it's farewell. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.